You're listening to a Bible study by Jack Kelly. For more free Bible study resources, visit our website at gracethroughfaith.com.
All right, in this study then, we're going to be in the book of Revelation, chapters 21 and 22. Now, you remember we talked last time in Revelation 20 about the fact that even though John was starting chapter 20 at the beginning of the millennium, he actually talked about two issues. One was the final disposition of Satan, and the other was the resurrection of the unsaved, both of which happened not at the beginning of the millennium, but at the end. But since he was speaking about the millennium, he carried those two topics all the way through to the end. And so starting in Revelation 20, verse 7, when he says, when the 1,000 years are over, he goes on and talks about what's going to happen there at the end of the millennium. And so you have these two topics then, Satan's doom and the judgment of the dead, the great white throne judgment, that actually takes place at the end of the millennium. Some people don't realize that when you get to chapter 21, he backs up again to the beginning, and then he talks about two things that are important to us for the millennial kingdom. One is, what's the New Jerusalem like, the place where we'll be? And second is, what's the earth going to be looking like, the place where the surviving believers are during the 1,000-year period. We talked about the reason for the millennium last time, the fact that God uses it to answer three basic accusations that man has made. The first one is, the devil made me do it. You know, when God says, why can't you behave? Our answer has always been, the devil made me do it. That was Adam's answer, and he's used it ever since, and we've used it ever since. And so God said, okay, if I take away the devil, can you then live according to my standards? Well, let's try it. So he takes away the devil at the beginning of the millennium, bound for 1,000 years, the whole 1,000-year period, no devil on earth. Now can you live according to my standards? And mankind says, well, you know, you put all these unbelievers around us. You know, they're responsible for all the evil in the world. And it's a hard thing for us to try to live the life you want us to live in the company of all these unbelievers. And so God said, okay, zap, we'll take all the unbelievers off the earth. And so at the beginning of the millennium, no unbelievers. Now we've got no devil, no unbelievers. Now, can you live the life that I've asked you to live? And man says, well, you know, you went away and left us. You left us all alone for these last couple thousand years. And we had to fend for ourselves. And we don't think that was right. And God said, okay, tell you what, I'll set up an office in Jerusalem. I'll be there all the time. It'll be an open door policy, no appointment secretary. You'll never get turned away. You want to come see me, just come to Jerusalem and see me. I'll live right here in your midst. In fact, I will be I'll be the president, I'll be the king, I'll be the governor. I will rule the world, and I'll be right here with you for these next 1,000 years. Okay, so now, A, no devil, B, no unbelievers, and C, the Lord in our presence all the time. Now, can you live a life according to my standards? And of course, what we found out last time is we can't. There's no circumstance, there's no condition under which man can live a life pleasing to God until man has been regenerated. And so that was the main purpose of the millennial kingdom. Now we're going to see some of the detail that takes place during the millennial kingdom, and how are we going to live, the redeemed, and how are the people on earth going to live, and what's going to happen there. So we begin with chapter 21, verse 1. And John says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven, the first earth had passed away. There's no longer any sea. That's our clue as to what the timing is here. Because that phrase, I saw a new heaven, a new earth, is a direct quote from Isaiah chapter 65, 17. And there, the context is the millennial kingdom. So let's go back and look at that right off the bat. Isaiah chapter 65. And we'll see what things look like there. And we'll discover that Isaiah 65, 17 has to do with Israel. And it has to do with the kingdom age. Basically, the promise that God always made to Israel is that one day he would come back and dwell with them. And that's in contrast to the promise he made to the church. The promise he made to the church is that we would go to heaven and live with Jesus. And so if you're a student of Jewish eschatology, you discover that the promise to Israel is that one day God would come back like he lived with them in the past. He would come back and dwell with them forever. And if you're a student of Christian eschatology, you know that the promise to Christians, to believers, is that we go to heaven and be with Jesus. Chapter 21 shows us how both of those things come true. So when we go to Isaiah 65:17, Isaiah, of course, was a prophet, wrote to Israel. And in Isaiah 65, beginning in verse 17, we see something about what the earth is going to be like during the what the Jews call the kingdom age, what we call the millennium. And so in verse 17, you start off with the very same phrase that you started off in Revelation 21. Behold, I'll create a new heavens and a new earth. And then he says, the former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind. Nothing about the previous life would linger anymore in the memories or minds of the people. Verse 18, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I will create, for I'll create Jerusalem to be a delight, and its people a joy. In verse 19, he says, I'll rejoice over Jerusalem and take delight in my people. The sound of weeping and of crying will be heard in it no more. So no more sadness, no more trouble, no more of the strife that the Jews have faced for pretty much all their time on earth. Okay, verse 20 then says, never again will there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his years. He who dies at 100 will be thought a mere youth, and he who fails to reach 100 will be considered accursed. Now this tells us that they're still measuring time. And so this has to be something short of eternity. And the only period of time after the second coming left before eternity is, of course, the millennial kingdom. The millennial kingdom is still recognized by its measurement of time. We're going to see this in Revelation 22 as well. But the interesting thing about it is that it looks like from this verse that the long lifespans that were enjoyed by people back in the days before the flood are going to come back. That a person who dies at age 100 will be considered just in his youth. Now, we don't have any hope of ever reaching 100, and if we do, we certainly wouldn't be considered in our youth at that time. We'd be celebrated for having lived so long, because the average lifespan on earth today, even for Americans, is in the 70s and 80s. People don't live to be 100 except by exception. And yet, here it's going to be thought that if somebody only lives to 100, they're going to be spoken of having died in their youth. So that tells us two things. One is people are going to die during this period on earth. And two, that they're going to live a lot longer than they live today. And in fact, some believe that there will be people who will live during the entire kingdom age. Does anyone understand why we don't live to be 1,000 years old today? I mean, why Methuselah lived for 969 years? Why doesn't that happen today? Well, part of it's due to the fact that when the floods came, there had been a water vapor canopy that protected the earth from harmful ultraviolet rays that come through the universe. And that water vapor canopy deflected those rays. And therefore, there was no corruption in the cell regeneration process like there is today. I don't know how it is where you went to school, but I remember when I went to school, that was back when there was only 13 letters in the alphabet, of course, and there's a... But I remember when I went to school, what we were taught is, on average, the cells regenerate themselves about every 7 years. Some faster and some slower, but the average is about every 7 years. All right, so then if that's true, why do we age? Well, it's because the process was corrupted. It was corrupted by the ultraviolet rays that come at us now that bombard us. In fact, that's one of the biggest problems they have today when they talk about these holes in the ozone layer and things like that, because the ozone layer protects us from that as well. But before the flood, they had this water vapor canopy that surrounded the earth, and that canopy deflected all those rays. Well, during the flood, if you read the story of the flood, you'll find out that water came from three places. One came from rain. Two, the waters of the fountains of the deep were opened up, as God said. And three, the firmament collapsed, basically, and that was that canopy that was back over the earth. And that's where the water came from. Now, during the millennial kingdom, as we'll see in Revelation 21, it says there'll be no more sea. You see, when the flood was ended, do you know, by the way, that if you took all the mountains and lowered them down to sea level, and you took the sea floors and raised them up to sea level, there's enough water on earth to cover it all over to a depth of several thousand feet? That water is left from the flood. One of the great witnesses of the huge amount of water in Noah's flood are the oceans. They didn't have oceans like that before the flood. Genesis 5 tells us that the land was split apart, the continents were formed, and all those things happened after, or Genesis 10 rather, told us that all that stuff happened after the flood. And so one of the things that will happen is, and we'll talk about this more when we go back to Revelation 21, is that the earth is going to be put back into the situation it was in, back into the conditions it was in when God created it. He created it perfect. You know, he didn't create it messed up like it is today. And we'll see that the calendar is going to be fixed somewhere around 700 BC. Our calendars all had to change because something happened to the earth. The amount of time it takes to go around the sun changed. It used to be 360 days. Then it was changed to 365 and a quarter days because something happened. Used to be the Earth's climate was subtropical all around. In fact, they dig up animals that out of the ice in the polar regions that are frozen into the ice, and they cut them open. They find undigested tropical vegetation in their throats. And they say, well, how could this happen? Well, the Earth's climate was far different before the flood than it is today. There were a number of cataclysmic events that took place during and after the flood that changed things. Our axis is tilted by a number of degrees, and that's what causes our climates to be so severe. That's what makes parts of the earth uninhabitable. No, you can't live in the North Pole, you can't live in the South Pole, you can't live at the equator. And so God didn't create things that way. You know, if you stop to think about it, there's probably less than 10 or 15 or 20% of the earth that's habitable today. Three quarters of it's covered by water, right? So you can't live there. And then of the rest of it, some's too hot and some's too cold. And so it's an imperfect thing. We got 365 and a quarter day calendar. What's that all about? Every 4 years, we got to add another day. And then every 100 years, we got to subtract one. And then we got to do through all kinds of other calculations to keep things straight. That's not the way God made it. It's the way it has become because of the effects of sin in the world. Well, in the kingdom age, he's going to put that all back. He's going to put it back to the way it was. And one of the benefits of that will be, as we read here in verse 20, that long lifespans again. So we know there's time. Time is still being measured. We know that the lifespans will get longer on earth. Now, I wanted to make sure we distinguish between what takes place on earth and what happens with us, because then I'll show you in a minute these two are different things. Verse 21, they'll build houses and dwell in them. They'll plant vineyards and eat their fruit. No longer will they build houses for others to live in or plant and others eat. So there's going to be property ownership during that period of time. And people will have their own land, they'll have their own homes, and they'll supply their own needs. No longer will people be enslaved, economically enslaved, like so many of us are, to provide for not only ourselves but others. You know, for example, for every two people on welfare in this country, there are three wage earners. So three people, count them up, you three there, you support two others, okay? And so that's the way it is. Pretty soon it'll be one-to-one, and each one of us will have one of our own to support. But I'm looking around figuring out who's going to support me. In the millennium, that won't be the case. Everybody will be self-sufficient. Verse 22, no longer will they build houses and others live in them. So no more real estate developers. Won't that be nice? And then it says, for as the days of a tree, so will be the days of my people. So that gives you another clue of this long ages. My chosen ones will long enjoy the works of their hands. And so that tells us the curse is gone, because one of the things that came with the curse is the need to work for support. It was always intended that man would work for enjoyment, for pleasure. And it says here that'll happen again, that my chosen ones will long enjoy the works of their hands. Verse 23, they will not toil in vain. In other words, no working without getting anywhere, like I've spent my life doing. And nor will they bear children doomed to misfortune. There won't be anybody who has to worry about how their children are going to grow up or how they're going to be when they grow up. There'll be a people blessed by the Lord, they and their descendants with them. Verse 24, before they call, I will answer. And while they're still speaking, I'll hear them. It's because he'll be right down the street, you see. He won't be up off somewhere that we can't find anymore. He'll be right down the street. And so it's going to be a local call. If you want to call Jesus during the kingdom, it's a local call. And now in verse 25, the wolf and the lamb will feed together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. And so this is another thing that tells us between they'll enjoy their work. They won't toil in vain. Their children will be happy and blessed. and the animal kingdom will be at peace again. So these were all indications, signs of the curse. And so the curse will be removed. And there are lots of other verses that we could look at that would confirm that for us, except for the last half of verse 25, but dust will be the serpent's food. He doesn't get the benefit of any of this. He has been cursed since the beginning, and there's no opportunity, there's no option here for his repentance. And they will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, says the Lord. Okay, so there we have a picture of what's going to happen during the kingdom for the Jewish people. And we're going to talk more about them as we go through here today. Because remember a long time ago when we first started this series, we said the destiny for Israel is different from the destiny of the church. People who confuse Israel and the church haven't done their homework. They don't understand that the destiny for Israel is way different than the destiny for the church. Israel is promised, for example, that they will go through a period of judgment at the end of the age for the purpose of refinement. The church is promised that we will be taken from the earth before a period of judgment because we've already been purified at the cross. Israel is promised that God will come back to them one day and live among them. The church is promised that we will go to heaven and be with Jesus. And so the destinies of the two groups are entirely different. You can't confuse the two. And people who try to get in real trouble. In fact, if you're going to be an advocate of something called replacement theology, which is the view that the church has replaced Israel and therefore is inheriting all of Israel's promises, then you're stuck with the Great Tribulation because that's one of the promises to Israel is that they'll be purified through the Great Tribulation. So lots of people who advocate the post-tribulation rapture view also have a belief in replacement theology, that the church has replaced Israel. And so these are promises to Israel here in this passage. The reason I brought you here is because I wanted to demonstrate the fact that John backed up at the end of chapter 20 to the beginning of the millennium to begin with chapter 21 again, because this verse that John starts with in chapter 21 is the very same verse that Isaiah used in chapter 65, verse 17 to explain the millennial kingdom. Okay, so let's go back now to Revelation 21, and we got through one verse, and so the second verse says, before we do that, remember it says at the end of verse 1 that there are no longer any sea, and I've mentioned it to you before, the sea is lifted back up, and this water vapor canopy is restored, and that's what allows the long lifespans during the millennium. And so actually he's putting the whole earth back to the way it was, when Adam came along. Now, if you want to look at Romans 8, verse 19, you'll see a good indication of the purpose for that when Paul talks about it. He says in Romans 8, 19, he says, "The creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed." That's us. And so the creation itself is waiting for the rapture of the church, because that begins the process of liberating the creation from its bondage. It wasn't just mankind that was placed in bondage at the fall. It was the entire creation. And so verse 20 says, "For the creation itself was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, being Satan, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God." And so that's another indication that there's some big changes coming for planet Earth. And I'm one of those who believes, you can't prove this from Scripture, but I'm one of those who believes that one of the purposes of the natural judgments that take place during the Great Tribulation, the earthquakes and the meteor strikes and things like that, are putting the Earth back into the condition that was in when God created it. It's making this possible for the restoration of this. And so then we go back to Revelation 21, verse 2 says, "I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband." Okay, so now John looks up and he sees this holy city, which he calls the new Jerusalem, and it's coming down from heaven. And so it's not a city on earth. It's not the same as the old Jerusalem. This is a new Jerusalem, and it's coming down out of heaven. Now, I want you to notice that he doesn't ever tell you where it lands. because I don't think it lands anywhere. I don't think it ever really comes all the way to earth. The way the passage reads here, and as we get into its size and things, I think I can show you that it exists in the proximity of earth, but not on earth. And if you can hold that thought for just a minute, when we get to the dimensions of the city, I'll show you why I think it's most likely that the New Jerusalem comes down out of heaven and comes into some kind of a low orbit around the earth, sort of like a satellite would, or like another moon or planet would, but it's not any of those. And so I'm just trying to give you a little hint as to what it might be like. But it says it's coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride. Now, some people say, well, that means the New Jerusalem is the bride. Well, the bride dwells in the New Jerusalem, but the New Jerusalem is not the bride. When he says prepared as a bride, he's giving that as an example. Well, how is a bride prepared for her wedding? Every effort is made to make her look as beautiful as she possibly can on her wedding day, because that's the big day of a bride's life. And so no expense is spared, no effort is spared to try and make the bride as beautiful as she possibly can be on her wedding day. And what John is trying to say here, in my opinion, is that no effort has been spared to make the New Jerusalem look as beautiful and as attractive and as desirable to us as it can possibly be, as it comes by down out of heaven and takes up its position around earth. And then verse 3, I heard a loud voice coming from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he'll live with them, and they'll be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. Now here's, Ken, read verse 4 with me. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. So it's clear that the crying that he talks about here is associated with death and sadness and things like that, not the joy that we're all going to experience in an unblemished way. And so now you see that this New Jerusalem is different than the kingdom that we just looked at in Isaiah, because in Isaiah it talks about people still dying. You know, people who live to be only 100 will be thought a mere youth when they're dying. And he who dies at 100 will be considered a curse. That means there's still death on earth during the millennial kingdom, but no death in the New Jerusalem. The two are very different. Why? Because the New Jerusalem is populated by raptured believers. And once we're raptured, we are perfected, right? As 1 Corinthians 15 tells us, we go from mortal to immortal at that point. So no more death, okay? But on earth, there's still death, because the people who live on earth are not redeemed. They're still natural people, people like you and I are today. Because who are the people that repopulate the earth? They're the people that survive the Great Tribulation. That's what the sheep and goat judgment is all about. It's about some going into the kingdom and some being taken off the planet. The believers go into the kingdom and repopulate the earth. The unbelievers are taken off the planet, and that's why we can say at the beginning of the millennium, no unbelievers on earth. And so the natural people, the people who survive the Great Tribulation, some Jews, some Gentiles, but all believers, they remain on earth and repopulate the planet. They're the ones that reestablish, basically, if you will, the population of planet Earth. There is no dwelling on Earth by the redeemed church, because the redeemed church dwells here in the New Jerusalem. And so the two are separated again. All right, so we go down to verse 5 now. He who was seated on the throne said, I'm making everything new. And he sure did. Well, let's read the end of verse 5. And then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. So he's created a new heaven. Now, what does that mean? That means that Satan's been expelled, the rebellion's been put to an end, and there's peace in heaven. Remember in Revelation 12 and 13, we looked at the fact there was a rebellion in heaven, and Satan and his angels fought against Michael and his angels, and Michael defeated them and kicked them out of heaven. So now there's peace in heaven again. We come down to earth, and we find out that Satan's been bound, and all the unbelievers have taken off the planet, and earth has been restored to its Adamic, let's call it its Adamic state. So there's peace on earth. And in the Jerusalem, New Jerusalem, there's the redeemed. So we got a new heaven, we got a new earth, and we got a new race of human, the church. The only people ever created to be fit to dwell in the presence of God. All through history, God has tried to live with his people, Never been able to do it because people are sinners and God can't exist in the presence of sin. So look at it, look at Ephesians 2. I'll take your question in just a minute. Let's look at Ephesians 2 and we can see something that happened here at the cross. And while you're turning there, I'll give you just a quick review. And I'm doing this for those who have missed the bulk of the study because some people have this perspective and some people don't. So I don't want to confuse anybody any more than I will anyway. And so I don't want to do it on purpose. I know I'll confuse some of you by accident, but I don't want to confuse you on purpose. That's what I'm trying to say. So what happened in the earth when man first came to the planet? There was one family, right? The family of man. Everybody was part of the family of man. And it was that way until Genesis 12. And then God looked at the situation and looked at the circumstances, and he reached out to one man, Abraham. And he said, I want you to be the father of a new race of people. I want to establish a separate race. And he says, I want to work with you guys. And I want you to show the world what it's like to be in a relationship with me. And so he chose Abraham, renamed him and everything. And he said, you start off and you build me this new race of people. So from the time of Abraham forward, there's now two races on earth, Jew and Gentile. Before it had been only Gentile. Everybody was a Gentile. Abraham was an idol-worshipping Gentile before he became a Jew. Okay, he's the only man that's made this change. And because God chose him to be this way. And so Abraham became the first Jew, and he built this nation, this race of people. And today, everybody looks at it and takes it for granted. The Jews are a race as well as a religion. You can be a biological Jew as well as a religious Jew, right? Because you can be born a Jew, and then if you practice the Jewish religion, you are also a religious Jew. But there are lots of Jews who don't practice the religion, right? But they're still Jews. You can't stop being a Jew any more than you can stop being Italian, because it's a race of people, okay? And so they had Gentiles and they had Jews. Now at the cross, look what happened. In Ephesians chapter 2, in verse 14, it says, he himself is our peace, who has made the two into one, and destroyed the barrier, dividing the wall of hostility by abolishing in his flesh the law with its commandments and regulations. Now look at this. His purpose was to create in himself one new man out of the two. And so he took from among both Jews and Gentiles, he created another race of people, a third race. He called it the church. And the church is a distinct and different race of people. The only difference between being part of the church and being Jewish is the rest of the world doesn't consider us to be a distinct race. But we are. We're entirely different. Our origin is different, and our destiny is different than any other group on earth. It's different from the Gentiles. It's different from the Jews. In fact, Paul says later on, he distinguished these three groups. He says, don't be a stumbling block to anybody, whether it's Jew or the Gentile or the church. And so he divides us into three groups. And since the cross, this has been the case. God's purpose then was through the church to create a race of people that he could dwell with, because that's what he's always wanted. He's got everything else. You know, you can't give him anything except your company. That's what he wants. That's what he wants most of all. But he had this huge sin problem that kept him away, kept him apart from people. And so when he went to the cross, he solved the sin problem. And he says, anybody who accepts that solution is going to be part of this new race, and you're going to dwell with me forever. And that's what the church does. And so that puts the church in the New Jerusalem. So we got three groups of people, all have different destinies. Gentiles are destroyed. Israel lives with God on earth. The church lives with Jesus in the New Jerusalem. This is the home of the redeemed. And so he's made everything new. He's made a new heaven, a new earth, and a new race of people, so we can get peace with his creation. Okay, verse 6 now. It says to me, it's done. I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. Now, we're going to deal with these phrases a little later on, so let's save it for now. In chapter 22, Jesus is going to say, I'm the first and the last, the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. And there are three different ideas. A lot of people think it's just repetition of the same idea, but it's not. There are three different ideas, and so I want to wait and explain them to you all at once, because he only says two of them here. And then he goes on, he says, to him is thirsty, I'll give to drink without cost from the spring of the water in life. Verse 7, he who overcomes will inherit all this, and I'll be his God, and he'll be my son. So he who inherits, or he who overcomes, will inherit everything. So what happens to the people who don't? Verse 8, the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters, and all liars, their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. And we talked about the lake of fire a couple of sessions ago, and so we'll leave that where it is. But here's again the clear choice. The overcomers inherit all that we've talked about here. They inherit the kingdom. But those who aren't overcomers, they go into the lake of fire. That's the second death. So that's, again, the very clear choice that God has put forth all through the scriptures. There's two destinies you can choose. You can choose to go to heaven and live in eternal blessing with God, or you can choose to reject God and basically, the way we say it, go to hell and live with the devil. And we'll just leave it at that for this point. But there's the clear choice that's made again. The question is now, who's the overcomer? We tend to think of an overcomer as someone who works to rise above something, right? And someone who exerts a lot of effort and energy to try and be good enough to overcome deficiencies or overcome disabilities. And we always talk about it in terms of human works, but the Bible doesn't talk about it that way. Turn to 1 John chapter 5, and we'll look how he identifies these overcomers. Just back a couple of books, and we'll just read the first five verses. Everyone who believes Jesus is the Christ is born of God. And everyone who loves the Father loves his child as well. This is how we know that we love the children of God, by loving God and carrying out his commands. This is love for God, to obey his commands, and his commands are not burdensome. For everyone born of God overcomes the world. This is the victory that has overcome the world, even our faith. Now, who is it that overcomes the world? Only he who believes that Jesus is the Son of God. So it's by our faith that we're overcomers. It's by our faith. It's pretty plain, isn't it? Okay. And so we don't earn our way into this position. We believe our way into this position. I've always said that we're saved by what we believe, not by how we behave. And it's a good thing, isn't it? But you know, that doesn't mean, I got to insert this little plug for sanctified life. You know, it doesn't mean that we have a license to sin. It just means our sins are forgiven. We should want to live the life that God desires out of gratitude for what he's already freely given to us. It should be our response to him, because he put himself out there before we did anything. While we still hated him, he loved us enough to die for us. And then he said, here it is. Take it. It's free. For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever would believe in him would not perish but have everlasting life. The condition for salvation is belief, that the death of Jesus on the cross paid the price for our sins. Now, what should be our response to that? We should try to please the person who did all this for us by acting and living our lives in a way that's pleasing to him. Not to earn anything, because there's nothing left to earn. We've already been given everything. But to please the one, to say thank you to the one that doesn't need anything else that we have except our gratitude. And so, live a holy and pure blessed life, yes, but not because you're trying to earn something. All that does is insult God. Live it because you're so happy about what he's given you that you want to do something that pleases him in return. All right, verse 9 now. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the last seven plagues came and said to me, come, I'll show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. And it's not saying the city is the bride, remember, but that's where the bride is. She's in the city. It shone with the glory of God. Its brilliance was like that of a very precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates and with 12 angels at the gates. On the gates were written the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. There were 3 gates on the east, 3 on the north, 3 on the south, and 3 on the west. The wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So this harkens us back to the passage in Ephesians 2 we just read, that the church is made up from Jews and Gentiles. And so we see the connection with Israel in the 12 gates. We see the connection with the Gentile world in the 12 apostles. Verse 15, the angel who talked with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city, its gates, and its walls. The city was laid out like a square, as long as it was wide. He measured the city with the rod and found it to be 12,000 stadia in length and as high and wide as it is long. Well, 12,000 stadia comes from the length of a stadium. 12,000 of these is about 1,400 miles. And so this city is laid out on a square, and it's 1,400 miles wide, 1,400 miles deep, and it's 1,400 miles tall. That's big. In fact, people have wondered exactly how big that is. And the problem is we're not told whether it's a cube, which it could be because it's square and tall. Could be a cube. Some people say, well, no, it's a triangle. And a triangle has a square base and then rises to a point. And it's saying the 1,400 miles tall is up to the tallest part of the triangle. And they're saying that the Great Pyramid is a model of this. And that could be. We don't know. We're not told this. All we know is it's big. Okay, it's big. If it was a sphere like the world is, it would be about 1/6 the size of the planet Earth. And so it's big. It's where we dwell. Let's put this in perspective. Here's the reason I told you earlier. Here's the reason why I don't think it ever lands on planet Earth. It doesn't fit anywhere. If it was going to land in Israel, for example, it's bigger than Israel. It's bigger than the Middle East. Okay, so it would just boom, it would bury the whole Middle East. If it was going to land in Europe somewhere, it would go from the Scandinavian countries up north down to the Mediterranean, and from Spain on the west over to almost to Greece on the east. So it would cover almost all of Western Europe. If it was going to land in the U.S., like a lot of Americans think, then it would cover everything from Canada to Florida and from the Atlantic coast to the Mississippi River. So it's big. It's too big to go anywhere on Earth. And that's just if it was just its footprint. Now, how about its size? The tallest building on Earth today is about 2,000. The New Jerusalem is 1,400 miles tall. That's 4,000 times taller than the tallest building on Earth today. Now, what would planet Earth look like if it had this one building, 1,400 miles square, and 1,400 miles tall, sticking out of it? I just don't think that that dimensionally it fits on Earth. I'm much more comfortable with the idea that it comes near to Earth, but is separate from it. And so I've always thought of it as more like a low-orbit satellite, something that comes down and forms an orbit close to Earth, close enough so that the people on Earth can bring their treasure into it, because that's one of the things they do, close enough so that the redeemed can visit, because that's one of the things we do, but never touching, because, as we'll see as we read a little later on here, it's kept pure, it's kept holy, and it's kept separate from everything else on Earth. Yeah, verse 17, he measured its walls 144 cubits thick. That's 216 feet. So the walls of the city are 216 feet thick. Not tall, thick. Verse 18, the wall was made of jasper and the city of pure gold, as pure as glass. The foundations of the city walls were decorated with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth carnelian, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, and the 11th jacinth and the 12th amethyst. And I'm told that although these words come out of the Greek, and in the Old Testament you had the 12 stones of the breastplate coming out of the Hebrew, and there really isn't a very exact translation between the Greek and the Hebrew to the English, but most people believe that these 12 stones are the 12 stones in the breastplate of the high priest. And so I'm just going by what experts say there. I haven't done enough homework on that to be able to say that conclusively, but it sounds reasonable to me, so I've just accepted that opinion. Verse 21, the 12 gates were 12 pearls, each gate made with a single pearl. Some oyster, huh? Each gate was made out of a single pearl, and the great street of the city was of pure gold, like transparent glass. Well, the fact that these gates are pearls means this city is ceremonially unclean, because oysters are not kosher. If you look back in Leviticus 11, verse 9, you'll find out the Israelites were forbidden from eating oysters, and therefore they did not trade in pearls. You'll find out the pearl is a particularly Gentile type of precious stone, and there's a lot of similarities between the pearl and the church. If you've ever done a little comparison study between pearls in church, you find out the pearl is the only gem that's made from a living organism. It comes out of the sea, it grows because of the fact that it's an irritant. Has the church been an irritant in the world? In fact, didn't the church experience some of its most rapid growth in the first few centuries when it was a major irritant to the world? And it is removed from its natural habitat to become an object of adornment. And that's exactly how the church is born. The church is a living organism. The sea is always a euphemism in the Old Testament for the Gentile nations. The church pretty much came out of Gentile dominion. It was a major irritant, as we've already talked, and that was where it experienced its greatest period of growth. And at the end of the age, it's removed from its natural habitat to become an object of adornment. And so you can do a great little study on the comparison between the two. The only reason I go into all that is to say that this gives it a sort of a Gentile imprint than on the New Jerusalem. Verse 22, I didn't see a temple in the city because the Lord Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. Now that to me was a very interesting verse because all through the age of the church, we've been the temple for the Lord. And now when we get into the millennium, He will be our temple. And so it's just going to be a role reversal there. Verse 23, the city does not need the sun or the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp. Now later on we'll see that not only does the city have enough light for itself, but it also provides light to the earth. And we'll see that when we get to chapter 22, so we'll keep going on here. Make note in verses 22 and 23, you have the Trinity. You have the Lord God Almighty, you have the Lamb, and then you have the glory of God, which is always the representation, the Shekinah glory, the representation of the Holy Spirit. Verse 24, the nations will walk by its light. Okay, there you go. And the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. And on no day will its gates ever be shut, for there'll be no night there. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. Nothing impure will ever enter it, nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And so only the redeemed can be in the New Jerusalem. Only the redeemed can visit there. Nothing in its natural state can enter there. And although the kings of the earth bring their production, their produce, into to pay tribute into the New Jerusalem, they can't enter. Only the redeemed. And that's another reason to believe it. It's kept separate from earth a little bit because, you know, in the Old Testament, nobody could enter the temple. Only the priest could go into the Holy of Holies, and him only once a year and only after a whole lot of preparation because the temple was sanctified. It was set apart. People going into it would make it impure. And so the place where God dwelt, only those who are pure can dwell there too. And so only the redeemed can live in the New Jerusalem. All right, so that takes care of verse 21. That's what the home of the church, that's what your home is going to look like. This is where you're going to live. All right, now let's go to verse 20, chapter 22, and we'll take a look on earth again. We're going to take just a few verses here, and we'll look at another little view of planet earth. And so chapter 22 takes us back down to earth. John has explained now as much as he can. And by the way, by his explanation, I get the feeling that while he saw it, it doesn't appear as if he was allowed to wander through it. If you go to his gospel, John chapter 14, we get a little more detail because there in the first three verses of John 14, it says, Jesus was saying, you know, you believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. And so what that tells us is that big house is there and we're all going to get one. Okay. And so he says, I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go, that means I'll come back. And I'll take you there so that where I am, you can also be. So that's where we get our idea of conclusion, if you will, of Christian eschatology. We go to heaven, live with Jesus. And that, we find out from Revelation 21, is this place called the New Jerusalem. All right, now we'll go back to earth, and we're going to see some things that show us that God promised Israel he would come to earth and dwell with them. And we're going to see that in chapter 22 with a little help from Ezekiel. Because the most verbiage describing the millennial kingdom on earth is in the Old Testament. Because the kingdom on earth is the promise to Israel, not to the church. And so when you read about the kingdom age in books like Isaiah, where we just read. Micah has a couple of chapters as well. Ezekiel has 8 chapters on it. There's lots of stuff written in the Old Testament about the kingdom age. It's all in the Old Testament because it has to do with Israel. Let's just take a couple of looks here. We'll start with Revelation 22, verse 1. The angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. And on each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the trees are for the healing of the nations. Okay, let's stop there. This, if you didn't know something about the Old Testament, you might not think we had changed locations here. But the fact is that this river of the water of life, flowing down from the throne of God down the middle of the great street of the city, this is almost a direct quote from Ezekiel chapter 47. And so let's go there. We've been in Isaiah. We talked about a little bit from there about what life was going to be like. Now we'll look in Ezekiel and we'll learn a little bit about what the holy city is going to look like. And we're going to 47, which is the next to last chapter. We're going to skip around in Ezekiel and look at a couple of other things too. We'll go to chapter 47 first. Ezekiel's being given this tour. It started in chapter 40, and he's been given a tour of something that the Jewish people call the third temple. We call it the millennial temple. And there are opinions among Christians as to whether it's the third temple or the fourth one, because some Christians believe that there's a temple going to be built during the Great Tribulation, and that temple is going to be destroyed, and then Ezekiel's temple is going to be built after that. So they put a first temple, Solomon's temple, the second temple, Zerubbabel's, or more commonly known as Herod's temple. That's the temple at the time of Christ. And then there's something that some Christians call the tribulation temple, based on Revelation 11 that shows a temple during the Great Tribulation. And then they put Ezekiel's temple in here as the millennial temple, which makes it the fourth one. Now, I think that's wrong. I think there are three temples. There's Solomon's temple, which everybody knows. There's Herod's temple, which everybody knows. And there's Ezekiel's temple. I don't believe Ezekiel's temple is built during the millennium. I think it's built during the Great Tribulation. I think it'll be the next temple built. And I'll show you why I think that here just quickly. But I won't take the time to do the whole study on it. I'll show you where you can get the whole study on it so that you can get into that in more detail if you want. But I'll show you why I think that the temple Ezekiel talks about in chapters 40 through basically 40 through 46, describing it, by the way, in such detail that you can actually build a model of it using nothing but those 6 chapters from Ezekiel. And it's nothing like any temple that's ever been built. In the Temple Institute in Jerusalem, they have a model of Ezekiel's temple, and you can look at it, and you can compare it with Herod's temple, and you can see that they're different. The sizes are different. The shape is different. The fixtures are different. The furniture is different. And just about everybody who believes in literal temples in Israel believes that this temple of Ezekiel's has not been built yet. But here we go to verse 47, or chapter 47, first of all. Ezekiel's being given a tour of this temple in a vision. And he's got a guide taking him through this vision. He calls him the man. And so in verse 1 of 47, it says, "The man brought me back to the entrance of the temple, and I saw water coming out from under the threshold of the temple toward the east, for the temple faced east. The water was coming down from under the south side of the temple, south of the altar. And then he brought me out through the north gate, and he led me around to the outside, to the outer gate facing east, and the water was flowing from the south side." So 3 times there he said the water is flowing from the south side of the temple. Now we're going to, the next few verses, down from 3 down to or middle of 6, he's talking about how deep this river is. So we'll skip that over for now and go down to the middle of 6 where it says, "Then he led me back to the bank of the river. In verse 7, when I arrived there, I saw a great number of trees on each side of the river. And he said to me, 'This water flows toward the eastern region and goes down into the Arabah, where it enters the sea.'" Now, the Arabah is the Jordan River Valley. It's a geological rift that flows down through the Jordan Valley. And where it enters into the sea, that word stands for the Dead Sea, because the, The Jordan River Valley starts, obviously, up the north in the Galilee, and it flows down through, and it goes down into this rift, down into the lowest point on earth, which is the Dead Sea, about 1,300 and some feet below sea level, and there it empties into the Dead Sea. And these days, it doesn't go anywhere beyond that. The water never flows out of the Dead Sea. That's why it's dead, because there's no flow through it. And eventually that has dead. Now it says, when it empties into the sea, the water there becomes fresh. And so here this river flows from under the temple, from under the south side of the temple, and then it turns east, and it goes down into the Jordan River Valley, where it enters the Dead Sea. And because it's living water, because it's fresh water, and because it comes in such abundance, it actually turns the Dead Sea into a freshwater sea again. And then verse 9 says, swarms of living creatures will live wherever the river flows. There'll be large numbers of fish because the river flows there and makes the salt water fresh. And so where the river flows, everything will live. Verse 10 says, fishermen will stand along the shore from En Gedi, which is on the western shore, to En Eglaim, which is on the eastern shore. There'll be places for spreading nets and the fish of many kinds. There'll be like the fish of the great sea, which is the Mediterranean. Then the verse 11 says, the swamps and marshes will not become fresh. They'll be left for salt. That's at the very southern end of the Dead Sea, which is the area that used to be Sodom and Gomorrah. It's now covered by the southern end of the Dead Sea. And it says that area will remain salt. There'll be salt marshes down there left for salt. Now verse 13 or 12 says, fruit trees of all kinds will grow on both banks of the river. Their leaves will not wither, nor will their fruit fail. Every month they'll bear because the water from the sanctuary flows to them, and their fruit will serve for food and their leaves for healing. And that is the same river with the same trees that we just read about in Revelation 22. Okay? Keep this in mind. It flows from under the south side of the temple, and then it turns east and goes to the Dead Sea. If you had a map that had Jerusalem and the Dead Sea, you will see that Jerusalem sits up here on this basically fairly high mountainous region, about 3,700 feet above sea level. And then it drops off just east of Jerusalem. The elevation drops off sharply so that within a half an hour by car, you're down at the Dead Sea, which is 1,300 feet below sea level. So you go from 3,700 feet above sea level, you go down to 1,300 feet below sea level, in a little more than half an hour. And that's where this river will flow, from Jerusalem down this hill into the Jordan River Valley, and there it'll meet the Dead Sea. Now, the trick is here that the water flows from the south side of the temple. Okay, turn with me for a minute to Zechariah chapter 14. In Zechariah 14, we're talking about the very day that the Lord returns to earth. And in verse 4, it says, on that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives east of Jerusalem. Now remember when in Acts 1, when Jesus went up in the cloud and the two men in white stood there and they said, men of Israel, why are you standing there watching him? This same Jesus will come back in the same way that he left. Now most people interpret that to mean he'll come back to the same place. Because of this passage, Zechariah 14:4 says he will stand on the Mount of Olives. Well, that's where he left from. In fact, there's a church there today with a steeple, big tall steeple. It's called the Church of the Ascension. And it marks the place where he left from. And if he comes back to that same place, like those two men in white said he would, on the Mount of Olives, it says when he does that, the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west, forming a great valley with half the mountain moving north and half the mountain moving south. And so the Mount of Olives, which runs north and south, just east of Jerusalem, will be split in two. Now, interestingly enough, there was a company some years ago called the Intercontinental Hotels. It was owned by Pan American Airways. And they wanted to build a hotel in Jerusalem. And they wanted to build it on the Mount of Olives. And it came under a great deal of controversy because the Jewish people didn't want a hotel built on the Mount of Olives. There was an issue about some cemeteries and things that they felt need to be preserved. And so there was a big to-do about it, but it got resolved because when the engineers from the Intercontinental Hotel chain did their surveys of the land, they found out that there's a geological fault line that goes right through the Mount of Olives, straight through the middle of Jerusalem all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, and they pronounced the land unstable, and so you can't build your hotel there. And so they built the hotel south of there, and it's still there today. It's called the Seven Arches Hotel today because the Intercontinental chain is gone. You know, Pan Am's gone, and the hotel chain is gone. And that hotel is today called the Seven Arches Hotel. I've never stayed there, but I've eaten there several times. Very good food, and it has a beautiful view of the Temple Mount. But it's on the Mount of Olives, east and just south of where they really wanted it, which is up on the top. Well, here's my point. As Zechariah 14 says, when Jesus comes back and he stands on the Mount of Olives, there'll be a big earthquake. Well, there's the fault line. They've already found it. And so they can tell where the earthquake is going to be. And when that quake comes, it will split the Mount of Olives in half from east to west. So half of the Mount of Olives will move north, half will move south, and there will be a big valley there where that fault line is. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when that happens, the current Temple Mount and a good share of the city of Jerusalem will disappear. Because that fault line, if you stand on the Mount of Olives where Jesus left from at the Church of the Ascension, and you look straight west, you look right through the center of the Temple Mount. And so when that earthquake comes on the day of his return, it destroys the Temple Mount. And yet, if you go down with me to verse 9, let's go to verse 8. It says, on that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half to the eastern sea and half to the western sea in summer and winter. The eastern sea is the Dead Sea. The western sea is the Mediterranean. That's the same river that we just read in Revelation 22 and in Ezekiel 47. So on the same day that the Lord returns, an earthquake destroys the current Temple Mount and creates a valley which fills with water, half of which flows to the east into the Dead Sea, half flows to the west into the Mediterranean Sea. Now, if you put two and two together, what you discover is that the Temple Mount gets destroyed on the day the Lord returns. And yet, the water which makes this river flows from underneath the temple. And it begins flowing on that day. Verse 8 says, on that day, water will begin flowing. Ezekiel 47 says it comes out from under the south side of the temple and flows south. Well, by deduction, that means the temple is somewhere north of the city of Jerusalem. Not in the city at all. Not on the current Temple Mount, but somewhere north. And the water flows south until it hits this ravine that's been created. And then it splits and flows half to the Mediterranean and half to the Dead Sea. And everything we just read comes true. But that requires, you see, that there be a temple standing on the day the Lord returns. And it cannot be destroyed on that day like the Temple Mount will be. Therefore, it can't be built on the Temple Mount. Now you discover, if you read chapter 48 of Ezekiel, you discover that in the distribution of land in Israel at the millennial kingdom, the city where the temple exists is not Jerusalem. It's located about 12 miles north of Jerusalem in a place that in the Bible is called Shiloh. It's where the tabernacle stood for 400 years. If there's a temple built in Jerusalem, and I believe there will be soon, I don't believe it'll be built on the Temple Mount. I believe that when conditions are made right so the temple can be built, which, in my opinion, follows the Battle of Ezekiel 38, the people deciding to build the temple will be taken to Ezekiel chapter 48 and shown that the next temple is not supposed to be on the Temple Mount. Because Ezekiel 48 locates it north of the temple. And if that's the case, the water that flows out the south side of the temple and flows south will flow right down to where the temple used to be. It'll fill the ravine made by the earthquake, half to the east and half to the west. And that's why I believe Ezekiel's temple is the third temple, not the fourth. It's the temple that gets defiled during the Great Tribulation and is purified for use in the millennium, just like Zerubbabel's temple was defiled during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, purified and used again during the Feast of Hanukkah. In fact, I think the Feast of Hanukkah is prophetic of the cleansing of the millennial temple as well as being historic of the cleansing of the second temple. Now, if you want to know more about that, and you may not, and I don't blame you if you don't, on our website, there's an article called The Coming Temple. It goes into all this in great detail, explains it ad nauseum. But just for today, let's just leave it at that. And if it triggers your imagination, if you want to know more about it, you can get it there. If you've already heard more than you want to know, then we can move on, and you don't have to worry about it. But if you want to hear it, go to www.gracethroughfaith.com, and in the search box on the upper right hand corner, just write Coming Temple, click, and the article will come up, and it'll give you all the background and detail. And by the way, this is not my idea. Tim LaHaye, you're probably familiar with that name, wrote the Left Behind series. He's come to that conclusion. I believe the conclusion first was brought forth about 100 or so years ago by Clarence Larkin. In my opinion, nobody's ever refuted it. I came to this conclusion about 10 years ago. I noticed in an article by Tim LaHaye in his newsletter about 4 years ago that he has now come to the same conclusion. More and more people are starting to see that there's no way on earth that either God or the rest of the world would permit his temple to stand side by side with the Dome of the Rock, as some people like to believe. All these things about the coexistence of these two religions in Jerusalem is fantasies made up by Christians who are trying to find a resolution. But for 4,000 years, the Jews and the Muslims have been fighting, the Jews and the Arabs have been fighting about this, and it's just never going to happen. There's never going to be a temple standing side by side with a mosque on the current Temple Mount. The current Temple Mount is defiled beyond use. You lay a finger on the Dome of the Rock, and 50 million Arabs are up in arms immediately. It's never going to happen. I truly believe that when it comes time to build the temple, by the way, Israel doesn't want a temple right now. They're going to have a huge revival, a return to God. The one, by the way, that's prophesied in Ezekiel 39, right at the end of the Battle of Ezekiel, a huge return to God before they even want a temple. And once they want one, there won't be any force on earth that can stop them. And I believe they'll build it in Shiloh. And you and I will be looking down from the mezzanine and seeing them do all this. All right, so now we're down to verse 3, Revelation 22, verse 3. No longer will there be any curse. We saw that in Isaiah 65. The curse is gone. The earth put back into the situation, the condition it was in before the curse. The throne of God and the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him. They will see his face, his name will be on their foreheads. This is talking about the revelation or the tribulation martyrs. You remember in Revelation 7 how it says that there'll be servants in his temple, they'll serve him day and night? Revelation 7, I think it is. 7:13. This is talking about them. They will see his face, his name will be on their foreheads. There'll be no more night. They'll not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light, and they'll reign forever and ever. This takes us back to Revelation 21:23. I mentioned to you before that the New Jerusalem actually not only is God the light for the New Jerusalem, but the New Jerusalem provides light for the earth. And so we become the light source for planet earth, which is an interesting fulfillment of the Lord's description of the church. You are the light of the world, right? Verse 8, the angel said to me, these words are trustworthy and true. The Lord, the God of the spirits and prophets, sent this angel to show his servants the things must soon take place. Number 7, then, behold, I'm coming soon. Now, that's an unfortunate thing. The word there means quickly rather than soon. And the literal translation will say, my coming is the next event. And so the next event on God's prophetic calendar when he gave John the revelation was his return. And for 2,000 years, there hadn't been anything going on. The signs that we're beginning to see, like the recreation of Israel and the recapture of Jerusalem, things like that, are signs that lead to his coming. But he's saying his coming is the next major event on the calendar. Verse 8, I, John, am one who heard and saw these things. And when I had heard and seen them, I fell down to worship at the feet of the angel who had been showing them to me. But he said, don't do it. I'm a fellow servant with you and with your brothers, the prophets of all who keep the words of this book. Worship God. He's doing the right thing there. Angels do not, legitimate angels do not, either desire or allow worship. So if you ever meet an angel and he wants you to worship him, you got the wrong guy. All right, number 10. He told me, do not seal up the words of this prophecy, of this book, because the time is near. Let him who does wrong continue to do wrong. Let him who is vile continue to be vile. Let him who has done right continue to do right. And let him who is holy continue to be holy. And what that means, it doesn't matter what anybody does on earth, these things are going to happen. And you can go on and be bad all you want. That's your choice. Or you can go on and be good. That's your choice. Neither one of those reactions is going to affect this timetable. The Lord is going to come regardless. Verse 12, behold, I'm coming soon, and my reward is with me, and I will give to everyone according to what he's done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. And here's where I said I would talk about these three things. Alpha and Omega are the first and last letters of the Greek alphabet. It's like saying everything from A to Z. I'm it. Now, I told you last time that those in Hebrew, that's Aleph and Tau, and you can find those two letters in the Hebrew version of Genesis 1, where Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning, God, and then there's an Aleph and a Tau, and then it goes on and says, created the heavens and the earth. Those two letters are there. They're not translated. You won't find them in English. But if you read a Hebrew Old Testament, Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning, God, the Aleph and the Tau, created the heavens and the earth. You go to Zechariah 12:10. They will look upon me whom they have pierced. Speaking of the Messiah, Israel's awakening to the Messiah. In the Hebrew version of Zechariah 12:10, it says they will look upon me, the Aleph and the Tau, the one they have pierced. And so this ties the creation together with the crucifixion and tells us it's the same person all the way through. John 1 says, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Jesus is God. He's the Creator, Genesis 1:1. He's the Redeemer, Zechariah 12:10. Got it? The Alpha and the Omega, the Aleph and the Tau. So he's the Alpha and the Omega. The next thing he says is, I'm the beginning and the end. Okay? This is a different idea. The Greek word there is arche, A-R-C-H-E, arche, the beginning. It means first in the order of time, place, and rank. And so what does Paul call him in Colossians? The preeminent one, right? He's preeminent. That's what the first means. He's preeminent. I am the first in the order of time. He was here before any of us. Of place, his position is higher than any of ours. And of rank, he's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That's what he means by being the first. So the Alpha and Omega identifies him as God. The first and last means he's first in the order of time, place, and rank. The word for last is telos. It means I'm the ultimate result or purpose of God's plan. So I am the highest in order of time, rank, or place. I'm also the ultimate purpose of God's plan. Then he says, I am the first and the last. The word first is protos. It's the word from which we get prototype. He's the prototype. He's the perfect example of mankind, right? He's what we all aspire to be. And in Romans 8, God says it's his purpose to make us into the image and likeness of him, right? What every manufacturer tries to do is make every copy look like the prototype. Isn't that correct? Any manufacturers here? The first thing you do is you design a prototype. And then you make the tools. And you test the copies by how they conform to the prototype. That's what God did with us. When he created his new race of people, he conforms us to the image of Christ. He makes us look and act like the prototype. Okay, so he's the prototype. The beginning, the protos. The word end is eschatos, means the best example, the perfect ones. All right, verse 14. Blessed are those who wash their robes, that they may have the right to go to the tree of life and may go through the gates into the city. Now, you remember that the washing of the robes is the idea of imputed righteousness. We talked about that a couple of sessions ago. Outside are the dogs, those who practice magic arts, the sexually immoral, the murderers, idolaters, and everyone who loves and practices falsehood. Outside means off the planet here, because the sheep and the goat judgment, the goats are the ones that are taken off the planet. 16, I, Jesus, have sent my angel to give you this testimony for the churches. I am the root and offspring of David and the bright morning star. Here's one we got to spend a little time with too. Isaiah 11 is where we'll go first to talk about the root and offspring of David. It's a messianic passage, and you've heard the verses that come after it, but you may not have heard these first couple. So let's go to that. Isaiah 11:1 says, a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse, and from his roots a branch will bear fruit. Jesse is David's father. And so this shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse means it'll be a descendant in his humanness. It'll be a descendant of Jesse. That means the descendant of David. And of course, one of the messianic titles is the son of David. And from his roots, a branch will bear fruit. That word branch is often applied to the Messiah. Four different times in the Old Testament, the Messiah is called the branch. Don't leave Isaiah yet. We got to go back to Isaiah 14 because I need to correct something for you that you may or may not have encountered. But if you do, it needs to be corrected. In Isaiah 14:12, God is bringing through Isaiah a judgment upon Babylon. And he starts off talking about the king of Babylon. And then when he gets to 12, he makes a switch here. And he goes from the king of Babylon, the earthly king, to the spiritual power behind the throne of Babylon. And we know that because he says in verse 12, "Oh, how you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn." Now, that's what it says in the nearly inspired version, the NIV. But if you go to the King James, it will say, "How you have fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning." And that's where the name Lucifer comes from. Now, that's not a Hebrew word, and so you won't find it in the Hebrew Old Testament. Lucifer is a Latin word, and it means light bearer, Lucifer. Luce is light, lux is where we get the word light, and light bearer, Christopher, Christ bearer. Okay, so that's how the Latin treats those names. And so in the King James, you go from the king of Babylon to Lucifer, the power behind the throne, and then it goes on to talk about the famous five I wills of Satan, Satan's pride that resulted in his fall, where it says, "I will ascend to heaven, I'll raise my throne above the stars of God, I'll sit enthroned in the Mount of Assembly, I'll ascend to the tops of the mountain of the clouds, and I'll make myself like the Most High." These were the five, so-called five I wills of Satan that resulted in his being judged and cast out. And the Isaiah 14 describes the process by which he's cast out of heaven. But somehow, in some way along the line, the phrase morning star got associated with this passage in Isaiah 14. And so people who don't like the NIV, for example, talk about the fact that they call Satan by the same title that Jesus is called. And of course, Jesus in Revelation 22, we read, is the morning star. If you go to the Hebrew in Isaiah, you'll find that the passage reads, "How you fallen from heaven, O Hallel ben Shachar." That's his Hebrew name, Hallel ben Shachar. And it means roughly the shining one, son of the dawn. Okay, and the phrase shining one is a name for the devil, right? Remember the movie, The Shining One, and all these different things? The shining one is always, and it means shining. It not means that he glows in the dark or anything like that, but it means he's always trying to get in the spotlight, okay, because of his pride. He always wants to be the one who's getting all the attention. He wants to be the object of worship. And this is his pride showing through, and this is how he winds up getting judged. And so the translation there in some of your modern translations, I don't know how many different translations we have here, but I don't think the NIV is the only one that makes this mistake. The phrase in Isaiah 14 should not read, "O morning star," because that is a title specific to the Messiah, okay? And son of the dawn is the real wording for it, ben Shachar, son of the dawn. But the real name for Satan then, or Lucifer, if you will, is Hallel ben Shachar, the shining one, son of the dawn. All right? All right, verse 17. "The Spirit and the bride say, Come, and let him who hears say, Come, and whoever is thirsty, let him come, and whoever wishes, let him take the free gift of the water of life." This harkens us back to John 7:37, Jesus standing there at the Feast of Tabernacles upon the wall of the temple at the time of the water ceremony that's tied to the Feast of Tabernacles, the prayer for the fall rains, and the priest is pouring the water into the parched ground to signify that God is going to bring the fall rains. And all of a sudden, this voice overrides everything. In the middle of the ceremony, this voice overrides everything. And they all look up, and there's Jesus standing up on the wall of the temple. And he says, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me, and I will give him water. For whoever believes me, out of him shall flow rivers of living water." And John explains that by that he meant the Holy Spirit, which would later come to the church. And so he interrupts the whole Feast of Tabernacles with this declaration that if anyone thirsts, let him come to me, and I will give him water. That's John 7:37, and that's recalled in this passage here. Now verse 18, "I warn everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book. If anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues described in this book." In other words, you want to put more stuff in the book? Well, you're going to have a problem. And verse 19, "If anyone wants to take words away from the book, God will take away from him his share in the tree of life in the holy city, which are described in this book. Now, some people say, well, there's proof you can lose your salvation. Well, the problem here is that the people who take away from the book of Revelation are typically people who don't study the Bible, who don't have a born-again relationship with God, who are intellectually familiar with God but don't know him personally. I don't believe you can use that phrase as a justification for conditional salvation. I just don't believe there's too many other verses and passages in the scripture that guarantee our salvation to take this one, which is a little bit obscure, and take it out of context and say that negates all those others. I can show you half a dozen very clear and unqualified promises that once you are saved, you're always saved. And in fact, it goes like this. Either you're forever saved or you were never saved. That's the only two options you have. You're either forever saved or you were never saved. Okay, and there's plenty of people who walk around saying they're saved but aren't. But if you are, you're saved forever, because it's not your job to keep you that way. It's God's job to keep you that way. 1 Corinthians 2 and Ephesians 1 and Romans and John and a bunch of others will all verify that. They are very clear and unconditional promises. And the rule of interpretation is you always use the clear verses to help understand the unclear ones. You don't do it the other way around. You don't take an obscure verse, pull it out of the context, and you use it to negate promises that God made. That's a violation of the rules of interpretation. A lot of people do it to prove their points. That doesn't make it right. You either are forever saved or you are never saved. Those are your two options. Okay, you can't get it and lose it. Verse 20, he who testifies to these things says, yes, I'm coming soon. And along with John, we would all say, amen. Come, Lord Jesus. The grace of the Lord Jesus be with God's people. Amen. And there's a year-long study completed right on time.
Thanks for listening to this study. For more free Bible study resources, visit gracethroughfaith.com.